Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Elise. Medical cannabis is now legal in Missouri, and host Keith Washburn talks with Mark Budemeyer, owner and director of operations for Casey Greenfields, a local cannabis consulting company, about who will be able to participate in the production and distribution of the medicine. Larry Riley was shot and killed in 2002. One of many young men and women who lived and were killed along East 24th Street during that time. Host Jeff Humfeld talks with Larry's mother, Rachel Riley, and sister, Charlonda Riley, about who this young man was growing up, what he was doing with his life, and his dreams for the future. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast. Now to Keith Washburn and his guest.
All right, good morning, and welcome to Jaws of Justice on KKFI. I'm Keith Washburn, and my guest this morning is Mark Budemeyer, who is the owner and director of operations for Casey Greenfields, which is a local cannabis consulting company. He's got over 25 years' experience in the legal cannabis industry, and I got to say right up top that I've known Mark for pretty much his whole life and thought it would be interesting to talk about the new developments in, you know, the field of cannabis. First of all, Mark, what is... You know, people say, you know, well, it's pot or it's marijuana. What is the difference between hemp, marijuana, all that? And what is the big overarching umbrella that all of this fits under?
Okay. So basically, the cannabis is the thing that's everything is enveloped under. From a long time, they had industrial hemp. And in the early 1900s, they wanted to differentiate hemp from some different qualities of the strains to where marijuana was actually what was showing to get you high, and they wanted to essentially turn it into an illegal substance. So they kept hemp as an agricultural crop. It was one of the biggest crops actually across the U.S. For a long time. And so but cannabis is the main umbrella that it is all enveloped under.
So all hemp is cannabis, all marijuana is cannabis.
That is correct.
So that, and we said earlier, we were talking before the show started, that what is considered to be hemp? Where is the dividing line between what I call hemp and what I call marijuana, since it's all cannabis?
Hemp is actually going to contain 0.3% THC or less. That's the compound that's known to make you high. And anything that's below that is going to be considered hemp. Anything above that is considered marijuana or medical cannabis.
So even if it's 1%, THC, that's still considered marijuana.
That is correct, yes. You can no longer register it as an industrial hemp product after
okay.
that.
So the most recent developments in Kansas City, now we're going to have medicinal marijuana available in Kansas City. Is that right?
That's correct. That's what the voters voted in, and they're trying to push forward legislation to and the regulations so that way people can start applying. That it's actually coming up here in about 3 weeks. Less than 3 weeks, the timeline will be you'll be able to start applying for cultivation or manufacturing licenses, and eventually we will be able to have a dispensary application that will go in, but that's they're going to go for the cultivation first.
So if I heard that right, there will really actually be three different licenses available. You can grow it, you can manufacture it, which I guess would be the processing, right?
Mm-hmm, that
and then
correct.
The third would be actually having a dispensary, and that's basically what we, you know, it's a storefront. It's a place where you can go in and buy. I don't know if it's literally going to be a storefront, but it's the place where you're going to go in and purchase medicinal marijuana only if you are qualified, right?
Correct. You have to be qualified by a registered doctor in Missouri, and they will be able to provide you with a registration application for the state, and then the state can then verify that your conditions, and then they will then in turn register you with the medical marijuana program. And you get a registration number, and then once dispensaries are open, you'll be able to use that to go in and purchase it. At the time being, you can register with a caregiver, and somebody can do home cultivation for you, but they also have to be registered with the state, too.
Okay. Now, we've had other people on the program, but let's just review quickly. THC is what gets you high. Then there's the other element of cannabis called mm-hmm. CBD,
yep.
which won't get you high, but also is said to have medicinal qualities. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So CBD is cannabidiol, and it doesn't give you the psychoactive effect of THC, but it does have multiple therapeutic effects. And there's actually over 100 different compounds that come from cannabis. and the only one that they focus on for legal purposes is THC. So there's going to be a lot of research and a lot of developments here in the next few years that's going to be pushing all these other cannabinoid compounds to really come up to the forefront for therapeutic effects.
Okay. Well, so right now, and even before the current legislation, you could have bought, legally, you could have bought CBD oil 2 years ago.
Yeah, so in 2014, CBD was actually starting to be allowed here in Missouri for severe sufferers and seizures. And so since then, the law change has really allowed for people to come in with businesses, and as long as they're regulated, but they are regulated under the hemp industry. And the FDA is working on trying to push regulations for different cannabinoid compounds other than just THC, because they've had to keep their hands off of it because it is still considered a Schedule I narcotic. THC is.
Okay. So you told me a little bit about this, and I want to get into this so we don't run out of time to hear the corrupt story of how marijuana became illegal. So tell us a little bit about that.
So it is actually very interesting. All kind of started in the early 1900s. It was actually right after the Mexican Revolution. There was a pretty big influx of immigration coming into Texas and Louisiana. A lot of people will say it's tied to money. Well, there's two things. When regulation happens, some people make money. Some people make a lot of money when people start regulating things. So the U.S. government decided to put in a regulatory agency, Department of Prohibition, which Harry Anslinger was in charge of that. But once Prohibition ended for alcohol, they had a lot of government workers, a lot of people in office that essentially needed work. So they formed the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in 1930, and that's when they started to target marijuana, which is just a derogatory term, Mexican Aztec origin, for prisoner. But they needed to differentiate between hemp and marijuana in order to get the public support for this. So that's when they really started doing smear campaigns. William Randolph Hearst owned almost all the newspapers in the U.S., and so he really pushed a lot of propaganda against cannabis and saying that it's the devil's plant, and it's sinful if you use it, and it will make people of color rise up and be overly sexual and take advantage of the white women. It was a very, very corrupt time. But when information is when your source of information is limited, you have to listen to whatever they tell you.
So absolutely.
Don't think it would work quite as well today.
Well, I hope not. Yeah. All right. Well, that's actually a very interesting story. We've had other people have come on and talked about cannabis, but we've never heard that story. That's really a pretty good background here.
Yeah, I feel like it'd be a really interesting story to tell in almost a TV docuseries event, because there's a lot of information and a lot of really kind of backwards thinking, but it's the way that they did it back then.
Yeah, I think a lot of our listeners would probably wonder still today, why is marijuana illegal when alcohol is legal? You know, that's an ongoing debate that's going to happen forever. So as you said, they did a really pretty good smear campaign to kind of kick things off. Mm-hmm. So people have always had this, you know, whatever you might call it, like scary effect mm-hmm. of marijuana and what it's going to do to you. And
yeah, this new word, marijuana, what is this substance? And from 1850 to the early 1930s, cannabis medicine was actually the top recommended by doctors for over 100 different ailments. And then it goes from that to one of the quotes was, I remember Harry Anslinger said, if Frankenstein's monster bumped into marijuana on the stairs, the monster would drop dead from fright. So that's some of the early 1900s. That's how they would scare everybody. So,
well, so what is the current, you know, problems, you know, as you see it, for the cannabis legalization and the cannabis industry, you know, which still has a little bit of that background, right, is still mm-hmm. kind of on its...
It is. The main problem that really on paper that exists with marijuana is it's still considered a Schedule I narcotic. So that means that there's no purposes for it, no medical uses. Highly addictive, it could be highly addictive is what they say, and that causes banks can't go into it, big business can't get into it, Insurance companies, if you work for a company that does drug testing, if you test positive for it, it's not that it's marijuana, it's that you tested positive for a Schedule I narcotic. And that's where their hands get tied with this. So they have to either deschedule or reschedule THC at least to get it to where it's on the regulation as hemp. Hemp products are now considered a Schedule 5. So the punishments are a lot less harsh. You can actually have regulation come in. Research can be done, even for doctors to do research on cannabis. If it's a Schedule 1 narcotic, they have to get permission and go through the channels to do research on a heavy drug, is what they would on paper.
So Schedule 1, does that mean is heroin and LSD?
LSD is on there. Heroin is on there. Those are some of the bigger ones that they put all into a group originally. And the general thought was that once they would do a little bit more research into it, they would reschedule it. But that's not happened since actually the 1970s, whenever they did the Controlled Substance Act.
So there are people sitting in prison right now.
Oh, yes.
Because they either mm-hmm. had they were in possession or they were dealing mm-hmm. marijuana.
Oh, yeah.
Which mm-hmm. is becoming legal in more states, not only for medicinal purposes, but in some states, such as Colorado, right, for mm-hmm. more than medicinal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they have social consumption in a lot of areas now. But even in Missouri, it was a really harsh place to be. I mean, in the early 1900s, you could be put to the death penalty for selling some cannabis to a minor. I mean, now you still do have people that are still going to prison. People are still getting unrightfully accused and arrested for it. Just in the last, I think it was 2015, 2016, and 17, there was more people in the U.S. Arrested for marijuana possession than any other violent crime combined. So marijuana wow. is still a huge filler for prisons. So
wow.
it's a big problem.
Yeah, that is good information as well. So right now, let's say I'm growing hemp, which mm-hmm. again is 0.3% or less. It's mm-hmm. got almost no THC in it whatsoever. But if I get caught growing hemp without the proper permit, do I get in trouble?
Yeah, you will. You still do have to go through channels. And since they since the Hemp Act in 2018 went through, that allows all the states to finally form regulatory agencies that can allow people to grow hemp and distribute licenses through the Department of Agriculture. That was the biggest problem, is that it's an agricultural product, but since it was illegal, the Department of Agriculture couldn't even touch it really for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. So that's where these other agencies, medical marijuana in Missouri, will be regulated by Department of Health and Senior Services. So,
well, you're an expert in this, you know, over 25 years experience and so forth. Can you tell? I'm kind of wondering, why are they so worried about hemp? But could the naked eye tell the difference between a hemp plant and a marijuana plant? In other words, they're both cannabis, right? Do they look
Correct.
Very similar?
Mm-hmm. They do. They are the same plant. That's the big thing. They're the exact same plant. If you had two orange trees standing next to each other and one had a lot of vitamin C and one didn't, you wouldn't consider that other orange tree something else. It's about the compound of what's in it. So they need to start regulating it by the compounds that come from the plant. And now you have hemp fields that look just like a quote-unquote marijuana field.
Right.
They smell the same. They're starting to breed those compounds back into them. So it's getting really interesting of what they're able to do with it in a short amount of time.
Well, let's talk just a little bit about the number of permits, because, again, this is going to be tightly regulated. And mm-hmm. obviously, they're going to regulate hemp. They're going to continue regulating that.
Yes.
Because it is a cannabis plant, and it looks exactly the same as marijuana. So who can possibly tell unless you do some kind of testing?
Right.
So how many permits to actually cultivate, as you called it, I guess it would be a grower permit per mm-hmm. se, right? Are they going to have, and you know, how many are going to be in our area, or how are they divvying it up in the state of Missouri to actually, you know, restrict the number of permits to cultivate marijuana?
So they are limiting it to a certain amount of dispensary licenses per district. Same with cultivation and manufacturing. As of June 20th, there was actually already 543 pre-filed applications. That's not actually the application process, but those are how many applications that people are going to be interested in once they open it up for that. So dispensaries, there's been 308 different pre-filed applications, and they're only going to be allowing 24 per district. So that's 192 licenses they're going to let go. So dispensaries are definitely the one that most people, it seems like, are interested in, but also there's going to be about half of those numbers that will be getting a license just from what they're releasing right off the bat. Cultivation, they are going to allow over 60 cultivation licenses throughout the state. But they're, like I said, there's 160 of those people are interested in. So there's still, there is some pretty steep competition for these licenses. And there's people that are really setting themselves up and gearing up with very strong teams, very good business professionals, people that are really well known in the community. And you also want to have people that have experience in the legal cannabis industry. And that's like what I was saying. So our team put together, that's where we have over about 25 years of experience in the cannabis industry with cultivation, manufacturing kitchens, and dispensing and industry compliance.
All right. So, yeah, you know, when I read this, I was in my head, you know, thinking 25 years, and then I'm thinking, like, wait a minute, does that mean he's been doing this since he was eight? So you're talking combined.
Yeah, the combined experience. Yeah, exactly. I've got almost 10 years actually in this so far myself. So
you know, not just everybody can, you know, go out and start their own medical marijuana growing facility because there's some financial concerns too, right? You have to show that you have financial strength.
Yeah, they're calling it, a lot of people are coining it a pay to play, which it can be a little frustrating, but I get what they're trying to do. They're trying to set this up for this industry to succeed. They don't want a bunch of people with no money to try and get this because this is a very highly regulated industry. They want to be able to make sure that you can pay your employees, keep your light bill on, and do everything that's necessary for the regulations. And all of those do cost quite a bit of money. And you can't expect to get your money on the back end, everyone get paid on the back end once you make money. They want to make sure that you're setting this up right. Even for cultivation, you can have electrical bills up to $100,000 a month. You have to have money to pay for that. That's not going to succeed after 1 month. So you have at least 6 months before you can really get everything going and have product ready and tested and ready for distribution.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me, even as a non, I don't know anything about cannabis, but you can do it inside, you can do it outside. Mm-hmm. We've heard for years and years of people who have, you know, a greenhouse that's just full of marijuana that they're tightly concealing, of course, because at that point, I'm saying a couple of years ago, it was not legal.
Correct.
But now that it is legal, growers can do it one of those ways or both ways.
Right. Yeah. And that's so the indoor growing thing that would have been a concept that had cannabis never become illegal. The indoor growing concept probably would have taken a long time to even catch on because you would have people outdoor growing and then eventually they would move into greenhouse structures. But really the indoor grossing and underground growing, that's kind of been a proponent that's really accelerated this industry, cannabinoid content, and even the research that we're learning from it, because all these new extractions and all the new science and testing that they've been able to do over the last 10 years, we're now starting to find out what causes cannabis to make you feel awake, what causes it to make you feel asleep, and their medical benefits from it. And true research is being done behind it, actually.
Yeah, so, I mean, various cannabis plants give you various effects. You know, I know enough to know that. And plus the stuff now, as opposed to when I was a kid, you know, when people were smoking pot when I was a kid, which was, you know, like back in 1902 or something, you know, they would talk about every once in a while, you hear these guys going, man, I got some really good, they didn't use the word stuff, but I'll use that on the air here, got this really good stuff from Colombia, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, Colombian gold or Acapulco gold.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and they still were really, really good strains. You can find really potent natural strains. It's just the curing process and the harvesting care that you take with it now, it preserves that quality. And also with the new strains that they've bred, they are getting higher potency. back in the 70s, you were looking 6 to 10% THC at the high end. Now they're cultivating strains all the way up into the low 30%, all the way 31%, 32% THC, and I mean that's like concentrate. That's like hash now. It's definitely changed.
Wow. So hash is a whole different thing. That's not a cannabis, is that
that's
right?
That would be a byproduct from it.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, looking of going 6 to 30, we're talking about a five-fold increase in the amount of THC in, you know, a joint.
Right. And that's any cannabinoid content. That's the interesting part, is that you can now start breeding CBD to get up to 20 to 30% in the plant. And so that also changes your cultivation practices. A farmer can make a lot more product from a lot smaller crop, as opposed to doing a huge spread of 100 acres and trying to process it out for cannabinoid content. And you can still do different other textile industry from the hemp plant too on top of it. So what they're doing is they're trying to figure out a way to utilize all parts of the plant from when they grow it, harvest it, extract it. There's no waste involved in any of it.
Yeah, so you could potentially, let's say, harvest some hemp, I guess get some CBD oil out of it somewhere or another, and then hopefully still use it for rope or other material. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, rope. There's a lot of cloth that they can make with it. There's some new technology that they've started to develop to have hemp to where it's really soft like cotton, and the processing, it does not take as much money to do. So that's a new industry that people are going to be starting to get into. Clothing manufacturing, concrete production. You can do stuff called hempcrete. It's really light, waterproof, and it's a renewable resource.
Wow. Yeah. It's kind of amazing. I mean, we're now catching up to what all this can be used for, because it was, you know, the Darth Vader kind of boogeyman sort of thing for years and years and years, I guess, starting in 1930.
Oh, yeah. A farmer used to have to pay a fine for not growing a certain amount of hemp on their farm. It was actually mandated by the government, Jefferson Tax Act. If you didn't grow hemp on your farm, you got taxed extra. So it's almost like for about the last 100 years or so, we've kind of brainwashed ourselves into thinking that something's not correct.
Right. Put people in jail, you know, and on and on and on, all over something that now we're going to legalize.
Exactly. We're going to legalize, and as long as you're paying taxes on it, they're going to be okay with it.
Well, let's be sure and give the folks your contact information. Of course, this will be on a podcast on Jaws of Justice Radio and KKFI. So later, folks, if you don't write it down now, you can get Mark's contact information.
Okay. So people can contact me at mark@kcgreenfields.com. And that's Mark with a K.
Mark with a K. Good.
Yep.
Mark@kc.
kcgreenfields.com. Okay. Or you can also check out some of our CBD products at abacahempoil.com. That's another company that we actually are currently working with, too.
All right. Very good. Any final thoughts before we wrap it up here?
Let your local legislature know what you want to do with medical marijuana regulation. They're willing to listen. That's what they're there for. This was voted in by 64% of the people in Missouri. So there's a lot of people that are interested in this, and really they want to know more and how it's going to impact their local community.
All right. Our thanks to Mark Buddymeyer and, of course, the KC Greenfields folks. And my name is Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for more of Jaws of Justice Radio.
Now the calendar for the week of July 15th. Survivors Unite is uniting families who have lost a loved one to violent crime. They understand that grief is experienced in different stages and help families heal and learn to properly release their emotions. Survivors United meets every third Monday of the month and will meet Monday, July 15th, 7 p.m. at Margaret's Place, 7217 Troost, KCMO. The Kansas City Chapter of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants will have their monthly meeting Monday, July 15th, 6:30 p.m. at the Chestnut Avenue Family Resource Center, 3811 Chestnut Avenue, KCMO. MoCure advocates for the human rights of prisoners in Missouri, prisons and jails, as well as those who have returned to society by lobbying state and local government, direct contact with corrections officials, and a quarterly newsletter sent to supporters and prisoners. The KC chapter of Mothers in Charge Healing Support Group will be meeting this Thursday, July 18th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, Suite 124 West, 3200 Wayne Avenue, KCMO. This group is for people who have lost loved ones to murder and violence. The first hour will be sharing of experiences, and in the second hour, therapists and others who can help navigate the emotional and legal terrain will be available. For more information, you can find them on the web at www.kcmothersincharge.org or call them at 816-912-2601. My name is Elise, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineers today, Mike Murphy and Keith Washburn. Up next is Jeff and his guest.
This is Jeff Humfeld, and what you were listening to there was Murder Jubilee by Garland Jeffries. And today we're going to be doing another one of our conversations with family members of someone that was murdered here in Kansas City. And we're not going to be talking about the murder. We're going to be talking about who the person was and what this community has lost with the loss of this person. And today we're going to be talking to Rachel Riley. Some of you will know Rachel from her work with the 23rd Street PAC. She's been president of that organization for a while. And she also ran for 3rd District in District City Council here in the last election. So her name may seem familiar to you. And we're going to be talking about her son, Larry Riley. And Larry was shot in October of 2002, I believe. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So, first off, I want to thank you very much for coming in and sharing with your, you know, with the listeners what your family's been through with all of this. If you want, you know, just give us a quick, who was Larry Riley?
Well, good morning, Jeff. How are you?
Fine.
Well, thank you. Larry Riley was my son, actually born December 24th. At the time, he was 18. He had not turned 19. Larry was a humbled kid. He was really laid back. He missed his calling. He had what we call hands, another Mike Tyson, but more on the slender side. loved children. He was the type of kid, he can get a whole group of kids around him. He had one that would probably be combing his hair, one scratching his feet. I'm like, that's no fair. But he was that type of kid, that young man that kids just loved. And losing him was something very traumatic in our family. I come from a family of 11, five sisters and five brothers, a mother that worked for General Motors 18 years of her life. My dad worked for the railroad 20 years of his life. Very close-knit family even today. God is good. My 11 sisters and brothers, we're still very close-knit. And so losing Larry was very traumatic to our family and something we had never experienced.
Yeah, that's the thing that most people don't understand is that when this happens, it's very sudden.
Yes.
And it's a hole that you don't just get over or get past or whatever for a very long time. And even then, it's still there. I don't know how many mothers I've talked to that, you know, one of the last things they think of when they go to sleep and one of the first things they think of when they get up.
That's right.
Is that child that's gone.
That's right.
And what they would be today. So how did Larry fit into your family? In other words, was he the funny one? Was he the conciliatory? He was the one that took care of everybody or what, you know?
You know, Jeff, yes, he was the humble kid. And he had so many nicknames, Boo, Larry, Stink, the Kid. His friends in the community, they called him the Kid because he was very outgoing. Like I said, very laid back. various cousins, nieces, and nieces and nephews. He did not have any children, but very loved by the family. Just a one of a kind young man. When Larry was taken from us, it was a very, like I stated, a very traumatic experience with my family. A huge, large family. We do a lot of things and come together. So losing him was, I mean, it was something that we had never experienced. It was very traumatic to my brothers, which were his uncles, his sister and brother. It's something you don't, no one prepares you for. You hear about the homicides, you hear about the loved ones losing their loved ones, and that's something you will never understand unless you go through something like that. So at the time, you ask God, you know, why me? Why my son? Why my family? And there's things that people didn't know when I did lose Larry. It was very devastating. It was, how do you wake up the next day? So I know what the mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers and nieces and cousins, I know what they go through, because even though it's been, Jeff, 16 years later, I can remember it like last night. I can remember going through the process of losing him, the fight, the marches, the cry outs, why? And God is an awesome God, because I can remember the day, some things people didn't know. I mean, suicide and things like that, you hear of that, you hear of young people, and you think, you know, what were they going through? I can't speak for that. I can tell you, losing my son, I was a lost mother. And God reminded me that I had a son, a daughter, a mother, and a family that loved me. And these are the things that gets me through day by day, each day being one harder, one being more humble than the other. But that's what it takes. The marches, the cleanups, the events, the loving on the community. Those are the things Larry would have wanted us, myself and his sisters and brothers and family, to keep going in his name.
Yeah, and we are going to talk a little bit about the walks and the marches and stuff. You had mentioned something when we had talked before, that Larry was very close to his uncles. He he tended to talk, you know, like you said, he hung out with kids, but he also hung out with older adults,
yes,
as well. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what that relationship was? Why the old the uncles?
Well, Larry came up at a time where he was a young man that he didn't have, like his sister and brother are younger, and he came up at a time where there wasn't a lot of his cousins his age, so he hung out with the uncles, which were probably 25 years older than him. So when the uncles were riding the 10-speed bikes, he rode his big wheel, and he would hang out on the corner with them. And so, of course, they taught him things he probably didn't need to know. I mean, if they were on the corner doing something, he was very good. I mean, he wasn't that people like, he was a great kid, but he was amazing. Money. He could read money. He could count money. And believe it or not, he was a good, from what I heard, a dice player. He could roll those dice and count those numbers. And you know, that's not something to be heroic about, but he was just amazing kid, and he loved numbers, and he loved kids, and that's what he did. So his age difference is what made him just, and he learned a lot from his older uncles. And to this day, we still have conversations, and Larry did this, and Larry did that, and he's just an amazing young man to carry on his, I would say, legacy of the love for his family and for his community and for children.
All right. Larry does have a sister, and I believe you said maybe another brother?
Right. His sister, Sherlanda, they call her Bear, and a brother, younger brother, Jean. And he looked up to his brother because his younger brother, like Larry, were into sports. Larry ran track. He played football and was good at it. Those things are something that, you know, he was basically involved, but he loved to watch his little brother. His little brother ran track. Like I said, he played football. He was in the Examiner. I mean, he was so excited to watch his little brother just, as we would put, get down on the field. He could get five and six touchdowns in one game. So Larry was excited about that. So he was a very caring person. He loved his sister. He would beat up any boy that looked at her strange. Because, like, as I stated, we called him Hands. I watched him get in a dispute with one of his cousins, and I'm like, oh, my God, his hands were so fast. But he got that from his daddy. So I guess, you know, as we would say, he would throw hands. So he was very good with that. But you had to really push him to go there. But as I said, just a humble kid. He was a yes, ma'am type of young man. Yes, grandma, to his aunts and uncles. Yes, sir. No, ma'am. So a very respectful young man.
Well, one of the things that you did and your family did to do something about what happened, and was the vigils and the walks. And I actually I actually went on a couple of those walks a number of years ago. So, you know, why don't you tell us how that came about? And, you know, I guess we need to put a little bit of context to the walks, in that this was along 24th Street, and during that period of time, there were a number of young people, boys and girls, that were shot and killed along 24th Street. There was something going on in that part of town that created this situation. But so your walks and stuff, they were not strictly for Larry. They were, you know, as far as your family, but you also had other family members who had lost loved ones as well. So why don't you tell us a little bit about those walks and how that came
Most
about?
Definitely. Yes, Jeffrey. During that year, unfortunately, prior to Larry being murdered, in the year 2003, there were 22 homicides in the area of 24th Street. That's on the east side of Kansas City. Pretty much not once but twice where Kansas City received its name, Killer City. And that year, 22 young black men were slaughtered in a 10-block radius in 1 year. Very traumatizing. At the time, my mom was going to meetings. She was the president of East 23rd Street PAC neighborhood. We were having talks with the Kansas City Police Department. Anyone that would listen, what's going on? Why the violence? What can we do to turn this around? So it was meetings that we were like, oh, my God, here we go again. But that's the type of person my mother was. I mean, like, this can't happen here. We grew up here. We lived in that neighborhood all our lives. When we moved there, we had a white picket fence. People worked. But at the same time, money was being allocated to that community on the east side. It was predominantly white when our family moved there. 15 years, 20 years later, it was predominantly African American. At that time, a lot of the funding that originally when we moved there was there, those funds had gone away. And the white flight went out, and in came drugs, and in came guns, and homicides were off the charts. So in 2003, those 22 young men at that time, we said, my mom and bringing my family aboard said, this is unacceptable. So we start, you know, looking into that. And then four or five months later is when the homicide of Larry came about at Truman Medical Center on October the 30th. So something that was just devastating, even though we were there and we knew these things were happening on 24th Street, for it to actually come to your front door and happen to your loved one, your son, your daughter, your mother, your father. You really do not understand the magnitude of pain until something like that happens.
Well, and that's exactly why we wanted to have this conversation, is to make people understand that, you know, it may not have hit your doorway, and you may, you know, maybe two blocks over, or
right,
maybe, you know, in another part of town, but it can come to your doorway.
And it will.
And
eventually,
it will, if we don't do something about it.
Right.
I had something written down about a family day in the park.
Is
that something that's you know, open to all families, or is that
definitely.
Just something that's just your family? Or
yes, no, sir. Jeffrey, just to let you know, this all came about 16 years ago when Larry was murdered. We after the marches and things like that, my mom, Joyce Riley, basically said this wasn't enough. There's a lot of pain in this community, and it wasn't about black and white. It wasn't about color, race, gender, anything like that. It was about people that were in pain. So what can we do to turn this around? So my mom started what is called Family Day in the Park 16 years later. It will be August the 24th. It's an event where every nationality comes together at 23rd and Ashland Square Park in the heart of the neighborhood where 90% of your crime is happening today, in this area that we have been diligently fighting to turn around and make it a more livable and safe community. This is the day, 16 years later, thank God, there has not been one incident. We have children, parents, grandparents. They all come together. There's the swimming pool is open. There's cotton candy. There's popcorn. There's rides. There's entertainment. There's everything you can possibly. There's health immunizations. There's anything you want to know about the community. There's free clothing giveaway. We just love on the community and say we are about the community. We can love each other. And it's not about color or anything else. It's what God would have us to do, and that's serve each other, and that's love each other. So it's a day that is one of a kind.
All right, and that's Ashland Square Park. That's at 23rd, and do you know cross streets there?
Yes,
you remember?
Right there at Jackson and
okay. 20,
Jackson and 23rd. You go one block, couple of blocks over east, and you'll be running into to Elmwood and Cypress. And literally, it's a one block.
I think I know where
the Boys and Girls Club. They're right off of 24th and Elmwood.
Exactly.
So go over to 23rd.
Right, just around the corner from Boys and Girls Club there.
Yeah.
What time will that start?
That is going to be from 11 to 3 o'clock. And again, August the 24th. And just to piggyback on that, Boys and Girls Club there on 24th and Elmwood, that was once upon a time a safe haven for the community. It was called Minute Circle Friendly House. It had burned down and was just sitting there, dormant, eyesore in the community. So again, because of Larry's death, we fought to bring in the Boys and Girls Club, which has now been sitting over 8-9 years, bringing education and skills to the community for youth to enjoy and come together, because at that time, you had a lot of children just kind of walking around lost. So it has been truly a inspiration to have the Boys and Girls Club in that area when it seemed still a forgotten area.
Well, like you said, as the complexion of the neighborhood changed, so did the funding.
Most definitely.
Let's bring this back to Larry just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did this loss affect his brothers and sisters? I mean, I think one other thing we really want to talk about is you know, what his aspirations for the future were.
You know what, Larry wanted to be, we would think, accountant. Like I said, he was great with money. I would say I was thinking he was going to be a boxer. Larry was a type of young man that the effect that it has till this day on his sister and brother. Actually, they both took it very hard at the time. They were very young, probably, I think, 14. His sister may have been 13. His brother was 16. They took that very hard. His brother, being a athlete and star, he lost focus. He was very angry. He would go on later running with some of his friends in college, still angry that he made a choice that was not a good choice, and he winded up in prison for 5 years.
Mm.
So, and even till this day, I think it's it's a situation like with any parents, you try to figure out what did I do wrong, or you're not knowing how this really affects the siblings. His sister to this day, because Larry did love kids, has the daycare owner. It's called La Tim's, named after Larry and his cousin, Timothy Riley, that was also murdered. But they both love kids, and so she is the owner of La Tim's Little Angels. And so, you know, the death of young people, you find something to keep you, per se, alive. So that is something that his siblings are still, and still his brother, are struggling with. But only God can show us and lead us and guide us in a place that we should be. These type of things that I'm doing with my family and community is what day by day keeps us humble.
One of the things I would like to do here is, you know, say the reason that we do this is we want people to understand that if they see something, if they know something, they need to say it. They need to tell people, because it makes a big difference to families like yours.
It does.
So I'd like to give the tips hotline here, which is 816, of course, and that's 474-TIPS. That's 474-8477.
Okay.
And in Kansas City, the murders that happened in Kansas City, Missouri, if you give a tip that leads to an arrest, it doesn't have to lead to a conviction, but to an arrest, you can gather up $25,000.
That is awesome.
And hopefully that's enough to bring some of these people to the telephone and say, hey, yeah, I got something to say. The interesting thing is that about a third of those tips, the people never call back and get the money. So they just realize, you know, hey, if it's this important, I got to do something about it.
Right. People have to understand that it is important, because at the time that was not available with my son, and I think we had a $15,000 reward. What happens when people don't give that type of information of things that they know, the no snitch law, just remember these things, death does come to us all. I think we have to do a better job in our politics and laws of eliminating the process where someone does give information about an incident, their information does not become public. I think that's the deterrence with a lot of people and the reason why they don't come forward, because I've seen situations where people did come forward and someone was working at a certain location, got their information and told the person that this happened to, that happened to be in jail. That person was able to call his buddies and tell them who actually, quote, told the truth, which on the street is called snitching. That person was able to have his buddies murder the people that actually gave the information. So those are laws and things that we need to take a better look at and change it around, because if that's the case, we're a lot of crimes and homicides are not gonna are gonna be unsolved if we continue to have these type of laws.
Okey-doke. Once again, is there any last thing that you want to say about Larry or plea that you might have to those people that are out there that may know something? That
most definitely, Larry Riley's case is still 2003, murdered in front of Truman Medical Center, has not been solved. It has been closed as a self-defense case. There are no suspects in the case. It's a case never heard of. You close a case as a self-defense case and there's no suspect. So I'm asking and pleading to anyone that has information regarding his murder on October the 30th, 2003, in front of Truman Medical Center, to please come forward with the information so that we can receive some type of closure for Larry.
Well, Ms. Riley, we want to thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about Larry.
Thank you so much for having me.
Melvin, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. You got the Penny Mill Community Empowerment event coming up this Saturday. 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Why don't you tell folks some of the things that are going to be happening there?
Yeah, and that's a good typo. We have on the flyer 10 o'clock, but it will kick off at 9 o'clock. That was an oversight on our part. What's going to take place, we're going to have various agencies like full employment, the health department, Guadalupe, Matty Rose, and we're going to have ad hoc group against crime out there. So in case anybody might want to come and maybe give some information on some of the murders that have taken place, they're going to have another opportunity to do that at the Pennymill Foundation. And everything is free to the community. We're going to have a police department, the SWAT team out there. We're going to have the mounted police. They're going to be out there. ATVs are going to be going around this, the area. So it's going to be a safe family event and with a lot of information. So it's going to be very informative. And also we're going to be raffling off certificates where people can possibly get oil change from Firestone and other businesses and stuff. And so I'm really honored that my sponsors have stepped up to the plate another 9 years of supporting the Pennymill Foundation and enabling us to do what we're trying to do, and that's inform and empower the community with some of the resources that's available to them. And they may not know how to network, but this is a great opportunity in a non-threatening environment. They can walk around with a hot dog in their mouth, a pop in their hand, and some chips underneath the arm, and ask some questions at the various tables and some of the booths. And also, I'm excited about it this year that we're going to have a petting zoo. And so the children really love that, even also the adults, where they can come out and pet some of the goats and sheep that we're going to have. And also, I've been informed we're going to even have some chickens out there. So I'm excited about that. And we're going to have some other agencies.
This is going to be at Blue Valley Park, and that's at 23rd and Topping over on the east side of Kansas City. Again, this Saturday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. If you're available and able to get over that way, stop in and see the folks. Melvin, we want to thank you very much for coming on and telling us about it.
Sitting here in my problem, what am I going to do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.